everybody, welcome to the Shema Shir. We're delighted to have Rabbi Alan Haber here to give his shir entitled Hidden Faces, a Psycho-Spiritual Approach to Purim, or to Megillat Esther. We also would like to thank Peretz and Tamar Tabor for hosting the event. I've had the pleasure of spending Shabbos with Rabbi Haber in my house. We actually overlapped in Gush for a year back then. We probably didn't speak to each other, but we've become very good friends over Shabbos, so I'm sure we're all very delighted to hear his shir. So I'll hand over to you with it, no further ado.
Thank you. I must admit, when I came up with this title sort of on a whim, I was on a bus, and Tamar emailed me asking for a title, so I just thought about what I was going to speak about, and I wrote this. My wife told me afterwards that it sounded like the title of a horror movie or something. But I'll try to... That wasn't the intention. That wasn't the intention at all. Hidden Faces. Chazal tell us, famous midrash, the Gemara, I believe it's a Gemara, Esther min haTorah minayin. Where, Esther, of course, the miracle that we celebrate on Purim, which took place thousands of years after the Torah was completed, where... The rabbis ask, where can we find a hint in the Torah for this idea, for Esther, for the miracle that happened in her time? And the Gemara quotes a pasuk at the end of Sefer Dvarim, Va'anochi haster astir panai bayomahu. God says, I will hide my face. And there's a play on words there, the name Esther, which means hidden. So haster, astir, hidden, that's the seen as a remez, seen as a hint to haster panim, to the hiding of the face. God hid his face. It's probably for that reason that there's an ancient minhag quoted by the Rama in the Shulchan Aruch to wear masks. Today we've embellished that in all sorts of costumes, and not sure that the child dressed up as the Ninja Turtle or whatever it is was the original intention, but the idea that we wear masks on Purim, hide our face, is an ancient idea that seems to be drawn from this midrash. And the truth is, there are different forms of hidden faces. There's different forms of hester panim. That is there a time frame for this shir, by the way? Don't tell me no, because how?
6 hours.
I'll try to keep it no longer than four, I promise. Seriously, is there a set time? No, okay. That's it. There's probably at least three different forms of hidden faces that Purim represents. I think normally when we think about this concept, and assumedly the idea, the message of wearing the masks, what that minhag is probably trying to bring out, is that the miracle took place in a hidden way. What's called a nes nistar. It was a hidden miracle. It's often been pointed out that God's name, Megillat Esther, is the only book in the entire Tanakh where God's name is not mentioned. And that's very, very significant. And as one can read Megillat Esther, and one can read it, and that's what we're going to do, Bezrat Hashem, in a moment or two, to read it on one level as a completely human story, as an interaction between people, as if God is not involved in it at all. And of course He is. Of course He is, and we acknowledge that openly on Purim when we recite Al HaNisim. We acknowledge that this is a miracle that was wrought by God, but He did so in a hidden way. His face was hidden. And therefore, one needs to look, dig down beneath the surface to see that the miracle was brought about by God. But of course, the Pasuk in Dvarim, which the Gemara quotes, when the pasuk says, I told you this chair is not going to last very long. When the pasuk says Vanochi haster astir panai, when God says I'm going to hide my face, He's not talking about doing miracles in the hidden way. He's not talking about hiding His salvation. He's talking actually about the opposite. It says that's a nivuat puranut. That's a prophecy of great disaster that's going to happen. And assuming that when God hides His face from us, it's not a positive thing. It's a punishment. And therefore, probably when the Gemara said, Esther min haTorah minayin, and when the Gemara said, that pasuk, that God will hide His face, is to be seen as sort of a hint or sort of a premonition of the story of Esther wasn't speaking about the fact that the ultimate miracle came about through hiding a face, but rather that God hid his face from us, and that's what brought about the great threat that could have been, God forbid, a terrible calamity. That was a sign of Hester Panim. So it's fitting that after God hid his face as if he wasn't there, and suddenly it seemed as if we were threatened with destruction because of this evil enemy of ours who had risen to such power, that the salvation also comes about. Both the threat of destruction and the salvation all comes about with God's face hidden. But tonight I want to look at a different aspect of hidden faces, a different sort of Hester Panim that I think also can be seen in Megillat Esther. And that is the fact that since God hid his face, and the miracle ultimately was brought about through humans, all humans have these hidden faces. We have aspects of our personalities that we hide from our friends and neighbors. Sometimes we reveal them to our closest, to our spouse, to our close family members. But often, our true face is hidden even from ourselves. And I think that that's also a theme that runs through Megillat Esther. And that's what I want to try to develop tonight, to see how the miracle took place as an interplay between God, who's hiding his face and operating beneath the surface in a way that you have to look very deeply to see, and brings about the salvation through people who discover their own, particularly Esther, as we'll see, who discovers her own hidden face and brings about the salvation through that. And I think there's a very powerful message which I hope will emerge in the next few minutes. One can look at Megillat Esther like any book in Tanakh in all sorts of different ways. One can study it with the insights of the rabbis and the Midrash, which I'm not going to do too much tonight. Maybe one or two Midrashim I'll mention briefly. One can read the Pshat, the simple reading, simple meaning of the text, which is what I'm going to try to do tonight. One could also avail oneself of the tools that are now available within discoveries of modern scholarship and history and things of that nature, which Dafke Megillat Esther raises certain types of questions. We don't know that much about Persian history, but what we do know makes it, it's not clear which of the Persian kings Achashverosh is meant to be. But I want to deal with the text as it's written, and let's just try to see. So that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to go through, we're not going to read the whole thing inside, of course, but I'd like to go through parts of the Megillah with you, and just read the text as it's presented to us, and try to analyze the four basic figures that dominate the Megillah. There's other, what I guess today would be called supporting characters, but there are four main figures. The story that's told by the Megillah is an interplay really between Achashverosh and Haman and Mordechai and Esther. Right? Those are the four individuals who dominate the story. Everything else is sort of revolves around them. So I'd like to start by taking a look at each of them as presented to us in the text of the Megillah, and try to see from the text what sort of personality, what sort of psychological traits each one is meant to. I didn't realize I was speaking to a group that included several professional psychologists, so you'll tell me afterwards if I'm what I'm saying is accurate, but this is just my own. By the way, this is a shiur that I've developed over the years. Some of it's based on classic Mefarshim, and particularly the Malbim, but I don't even remember anymore what things are my own insights or what I've heard from other people. So we learned from the Megillah that you're supposed to say things B'Shem Omro in the name of the person who said it, but I'm not sure I'm able to do that, so I apologize in advance. Okay. So let's start from the beginning. And the first person we meet is Achashverosh. And the Megillah tells us, Vayehi bimei Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh hamolech mehodu ve'ad kush sheva ve'asimu me'am medina. We have here a description of an emperor who rules over a vast empire, mehodu ve'ad kush, from India to probably Ethiopia or somewhere else in Africa, pretty much the entire Middle East, and historically that is the extent of, or almost the extent at least, of what we know that the Persian Empire at its height reached. As I said, we don't know which Persian king this is meant to be. We don't know exactly at which point in the, there's a whole discussion, Chazal have it at one point, and some scholars think it was a slightly different point, but in any case, there is one midrash that I think is worth mentioning here. Rashi quotes it on the first word, hamolech, he rules in the present tense. Rashi seems to, based on the Midrash, says that this king, who's called here Achashverosh, was not the son of the previous king. Again, I don't know to what extent this fits in with what we know about Persian history, but let's just take the text as it's written here, that this king, Achashverosh, was not the son of the previous king. He had usurped the throne. And there is a Midrashic idea, which I think will enhance what we're going to see in the text in a few moments, that his wife Vashti was herself the daughter of the previous king. But in any case, let's just look at this figure of this king who's ruling this vast empire. And let's just try to get a picture of what sort of an individual we're dealing with. What does it tell us here? Bayamim ahem keshevet hamelech Achashverosh al kisei malchuto asher b'shushan habirah. He was seated on the throne in the capital Shushan, b'shnat shalosh l'malcho, he's been king for 3 years. Asa mishteh. He made a party. He made some sort of a celebration. L'chol sarav havadav chel parasu madai apartamim v'sarei medinot l'fanav. He made some sort of a celebration for all of the officers, all of the government apparatus, the VIPs of the empire. And what's the nature of this celebration? Behar oto et osher kivod malchuto. So that he could display his wealth and honor, his splendor. Ve'et yikar tiferet gedulato, and his great power. Yamim rabim shmonim umi'at yom. This man who had a party. 180 days. And listen to this description, and it's significant, I think, the extent of the detail, the way the text describes it. He puts on a party for 180 days, that's half a year, 6 months, for the entire entourage of all the bigwigs of the empire. And it says that the purpose is to demonstrate his wealth and his power and his splendor and his glory. And the Megillah goes and actually describes it in great detail. So first 180 days. Uvim lo taimim ha'ilen. At the end, as the climax, after the 6 months of this whole celebration. Uvim lo taimim ha'ilen asa ha'melech l'chol ha'am. Hanim tse'im b'shushan ha'biran. Migadol b'yad katan mishteh shivat yamim. Bachatzar ginat mitan ha'melech. At the end of the 6 months, as the crowning pinnacle of this, he invites the commoners in. All the people from the street are invited into the royal gardens. Everybody. Mi gadol b'yad katan. The entire kingdom is invited into the royal to partake of the final 7 days of this celebration. And what did they see? Imagine the commoner for the first time in his life, maybe the only time in his life, he's being, you know, he sees these palace gates that are, you know, locked away, and here he's invited in. And what does he see there? Chur karpasu tchelet achuz b'chav levutz b'argaman al glile kesef amudei sheish. He sees all sorts of pillars filled with all sorts of exquisite and expensive materials and silver and gold. Mitod zahav v'chesef al ritzpat bat v'sheish v'dar v'sokharet. Marble floors, all sorts of wealth beyond that which the average person could possibly imagine. V'hashkot b'chlei zahav. Everyone's given to drink in golden goblets, right? Imagine the commoner from the street is a bar and he's handed a solid gold goblet. The kelim mikelim shonim v'yei malchut rav kiyad ha'melech, free bar, open, endless drinks. Bashtia kadat ein ones kichen yisar ha'melech, etc. So there's this huge, huge, huge party. It goes on for an exceedingly long time. 180 days for the VIPs, and then 7 days for the entire populace. In a moment, we'll see what the climax of it is. But let's just pause for a moment. Let's just take a snapshot. When you see this, what picture do we have of this king Achashverosh? What do we? Give me a word. Give me a name.
Insecure.
Right? Right. He seems very, very paranoid.
Fun.
What?
Fun and generous.
Fun and generous.
Fun?
Yeah.
Yeah. But he seems to have this need to show how great he is, right? And, again, if we take the Midrash that he was not the legitimate king, right? Perhaps that's part of where the insecurities coming from. It also seems from the continuation of the story that he had reason to be concerned. There was an assassination plot that was foiled, right? But somebody was out to get him. So we're talking about a king who seems to be very, very insecure, and he's trying to buttress his position. And what's the climax of it all? Here it is, at the end of this, now 187 days, right? The climax, the crowning moment of what he's trying to accomplish is the following. Skip a few psukim here. Bayom HaShvi'i, Pasuk Yud. Bayom HaShvi'i, on the seventh day. This is the last day of this whole celebration. Kitov Lev HaMelech Bayayin. Amar, he calls his various top officers, and he gives them the command, Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, Lehavi et Vashti HaMalka lifnei HaMelech b'cheter Malchut, to bring the queen Vashti wearing the royal crown, Leharot ha'amim b'asarim et yofia ki tovat mar'evi, in order to show how beautiful she is. Now there are many ways in which this pasuk can be read. A whole separate topic, which is worthy of a shir in its own, is the position of women in Megillat Esther. It's quite clear that the Persians did not value women, women did not have a very place of great esteem in Persian eyes.
Commodities.
At best. But what's interesting here, again, especially if we take the idea from that Midrash that she was the daughter of the previous king, like the legitimate heir to the throne, so to speak. Some of the Midrash, I think Rashi quotes this as well. There's a hint here that perhaps she was to come without clothing on, right? She's wearing Keter Malkut and nothing else. But what's emphasized in the Pasuk itself specifically are two things. She's to come Becheter Malkut. She's to come wearing the royal crown. Again, and if she is the legitimate heir to the throne, that's a very significant thing for him to show. And she's to come in order to show how beautiful she is. Meaning, he needs to show that she, who's wearing the royal crown, is subservient to him. She's his servant, right? She's his queen, even though she's wearing the royal crown, by virtue of her beauty. Not by virtue of any legitimate right she has. He's the king, right? And this is meant to be he's putting on this show for over half a year now, in order to buttress his claim to the throne, in order to build support, to show his wealth and power and glory, and as the pinnacle, he wants to bring the queen Vashti, wearing the royal crown, in a manner that makes it very clear that she's subservient to him, and that he is the one who's, the king.
But it says Ketov Lev HaMelech B'Yayin, which implies it's an afterthought. This is not premeditated. It's just on the spur of the moment.
Okay, it's possible. I don't know if it has to imply that. It could. It could. It could be a spontaneous thing, and it could be something that he regrets later. And if that's true, why would he have not planned it Merosh? Why would he have not planned it originally? Perhaps because there was a risk involved. It backfired on him. Why did it backfire? Because it seems that Vashti wasn't interested in being treated that way, right? And she, therefore, refuses. Batima'in. She refuses to come. Right? She says, I'm not playing this game. I'm not going to allow him to, again, we don't know to what extent maybe she has her own power base. She had her own party going on for the women. Right? To what extent she has, perhaps, that's not clear in the psukim. It's also not clear, by the way, what happens to her afterwards. I'll get to that in a moment. Okay, so it could be that if what he did was a sort of spontaneous, quasi-drunken decision, it could be because it wasn't necessarily the smartest thing for him to do. Maybe. Or maybe he was planning it all along. It's not clear to me. But either way, it backfired. That's the key point. It backfired.
Yeah, but by saying Ketov Lev HaMelech B'Yayin implies that is the cause of it.
It could
Otherwise,
be.
That phrase is very superfluous.
So let's take it that way then. Right? He is feeling insecure. He's feeling it, and he decides, maybe against his better judgment, to bring out this, you know,
trophy.
This trophy wife of his. That's a good term, exactly, right? And perhaps had he been a little bit more sober, he would have realized that that was a mistake because he knew her, perhaps, and he knew how she was going to react, and it backfired on him. It backfired on him. It would have been much better from his perspective for him not to try, right? He commands everybody to, you know, let me show you my wife, and she doesn't come. And now, he's feeling undoubtedly much a greater threat to himself, right? And his officers, who have to suggest what to do here, and Chazal claim, again, Midrash, that Minuchan, one of the key officers here is actually Haman. That's not the Pshat, but it fits in with the Pshat very nicely, as we'll see in a few moments. How do they react to that? And you see here that they're sort of playing, right? These are the people that rose to the top. And how do you rise to the top when you have a king like that? Right? What?
By feeding the insecurity.
By feeding the insecurity, right? We're on your side, right? And they tell him, Lo al ha-melech levado. Avtavat shti ha-melka, right? This isn't a threat to you. This is a threat to state security, right? Everybody, if we let this go, you know, everything, all these women are going to, you know, take over now, and they're going to start telling their husbands what to do. We have to put a stop to this right away. It's not clear, though, what happened to Vashti. It never says she was executed. Some understand it that way. All it says is that it could be that she was banished. Right? The decree was, Yikatei bedat, I'm in Pasuk Yutet now, V'lo yavor od, V'lo yavor, asher lo tavo Vashti lifnei ha-melech ha-chashverosh, U'malchuta yitein ha-melech l'uta ha-tova mimena. It could be that she was not executed, but only exiled. And again, if she had some power base of her own, that might explain, you know, why not execute her at that point. But in any case, Achashverosh, if we're reading this correctly here, right, we're dealing with a king who's insecure, perhaps paranoid, attempting to buttress the support he has from the population, and whether premeditated or not, and perhaps in a moment of ill judgment, perhaps under the influence of alcohol or whatever else, try to produce this show that would have been perhaps the pinnacle of it all and backfired in his face. Not only did she not come and show her subservience and show how, you know, she's his trophy wife and etc., but actually she demonstrated a certain amount of autonomy, a certain amount of independence, a direct threat to his authority. And his officers then try to do the damage control by telling him that this is a threat to state security and we have to. And it seems that in the end, at least in the short term, it seems that she was overpowered because she was either executed or at least exiled and removed from her position. And now, now they need to find a new queen.
So, sorry, why do you suggest that it doesn't tell us what happened to Vashti? I mean, obviously it's not important, but why is it not important what happened?
I'm not saying it doesn't say what happens. I'm saying it's often understood that she was executed. I'm just pointing out it doesn't actually say that.
Yeah.
It says that she'll never be seen again in front of the king, so it could be that she was exiled. It could be. And if that is the case, then that might indicate that why would she not have been executed for a direct threat to the king's authority? It could be that she did have some sort of a power base, and it could be that, you know, meaning it could be that his paranoia was not completely paranoia. It could be that he had a legitimate reason to be concerned, right? And again, I don't know who Bigtan Viteresh were, and I don't know to what extent there may have been more than one faction. But it seems that there were reasons for him to be concerned that there was a threat to his position. Okay, so we have a snapshot of who Achashverosh is. Okay, the next person we meet, we'll come back to him, of course, in a few moments. The next person we meet is Mordechai. We're told here in Perek Bet Pasukei, chapter 2, verse 5, Ish Yehudi. Just as an aside here, this is the first time in Tanakh, I believe, that we're called Jews, Yehudim. Until now, we've been called Yisrael, right? The term Yehudi, which has become associated with us, I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the earliest reference. But anyway, he's called Ish Yehudi. Hayab Shushan Abirah, Shmo Mordechai Ben Yir Ben Shemi Ben Kish Ish Yehudi. We have his lineage, which traces him back, actually, to Shaul HaMelech, and he's from the tribe of Benjamin.
Yeah.
And it tells us, Asher Hoglam Yerushalayim, Im Hagola, Asher Hogleta, Im Yechaniah Melech Yehuda. Asher Hoglam Nebuchadnezzar Melech Babel. Now, That pasuk is difficult because, again, we don't know exactly at what point this story took place. It certainly seems to have taken place at the least at the end of the 70 years of exile, which means it says here that Mordechai, if, at least the simple way of reading this pasuk, is that Mordechai was exiled from Yerushalayim with the exile that happened in the days of Yehoyachin, or Yechaniah as he's called here. There was an earlier exile 14 years before the temple was destroyed. Right? The temple was destroyed, and the prophet Yirmiyahu had prophesied that there was going to be a 70-year period of exile, and then they were going to return. That would make Mordechai, and this is at least at the end of the 70 years, except many feel it was, even, there's a Midrash Chazal that it was at the end of the 70 years, but that's also, there are those who think it was even a little bit later. But let's say it was at the end of the 70 years. That would mean that Mordechai was exiled from Yerushalayim 84 years earlier. And on top of that, he wouldn't have been exiled as a child, because the people that were exiled were the leaders of the society at that point, which means that he would have to be an extremely old man, probably close to 100 years old, if not older, at this point in time. It makes it a little bit difficult to understand. It's possible that the pasuk could be read a little bit differently, that Mordechai himself was not exiled. It says here that his name was Mordechai, and it tells us his background, Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Asher Haglam Yerushalayim. Perhaps it was his father, or maybe his grandfather, that had been exiled from Yerushalayim. So it's not clear. But certainly it seems that he was a distinguished person from a distinguished background, perhaps quite elderly, and assumedly respected in the community. And we're told that he had adopted, actually, Esther, who was his
cousin,
right? It's very common to refer to them as an uncle and a niece, but it's not true. It says very clearly that they were cousins. Vahi omena tadasa hi Esther bat dodo. I think people just associate the relationship. He seems to have been a lot older than her. So, you know, the relationship of an uncle and a niece, perhaps, but they were actually first cousins. And she was an orphan, in la avaim. And it tells us that she was very beautiful. We'll get to Esther in a moment. Okay? Well, actually, we're introduced to Esther and Mordechai together, so let's look at them together. So he's this distinguished person from a distinguished background. He or one of his ancestors had been exiled from Yerushalayim, and it means they had been one of the leaders back in Yerushalayim, and now he's from among the leadership of the Jewish people in Shushan, which is the capital. And he has adopted his cousin, who was an orphan girl. He took her into his home. And it says, Uvimot avia v'ima, when her parents died, l'kecha Mordechai lo levat. He took her as a daughter. He adopted her, so to speak. Esther was taken. Okay, it says that she was very beautiful. They were looking for beautiful young girls. She was taken. The word v'tilakach is in passive tense. She was taken. And we'll see that throughout the entire description of Esther here, she's completely passive. She was taken, and she's brought to the harem, and under the control of this fellow whose name is Higai Shomer Hanashim, the guardian of the women. Batitav ha'nara beinav v'tisa chesed lefanav. She's sort of, somehow she captured his attention. And he begins to give her all sorts of cosmetics and all sorts of other benefits. And it says, Lo higida Esther et amavet molalita. She didn't tell anybody who she was. She didn't tell anyone that she was a Jew. She didn't tell anyone what her background was. Why? Ki Mordechai tziva aleha asher lo tagid. So she didn't tell anybody who she was because her cousin Mordechai had commanded her not to tell. Now, it doesn't tell us why Mordechai commanded her not to tell. But we do see two things from this. We see that Mordechai seems to be a person who, it doesn't tell us why he didn't want her to tell, but he seems to be cautious. He seems to have some sort of thoughts for the future. Maybe he doesn't know exactly what's going on, but he's concerned. He doesn't want her identity to be known. So he commands her, and that's the word. That's the word that's used here. Tziva, he commands her not to tell, and she obeys. And that's what seems to be Esther's quality that we see here. She's passive and she's obedient. She does as she's told. She's a good girl. She's told not to do something, she doesn't do. She doesn't ask why, at least as far as we can tell. He tells her, she listens. ובכל יום ויום מרדכי מתהלך לפני חצר בית הנשים לדעת את שלום אסתר מה יעשה בה. He seems to be quite concerned about her well-being every single day. We see, by the way, that he has access to the royal palace. That also supports the idea that he seems to have been an important personage. He has access to the royal palace and he goes every single day to check out what's going on and to make sure that she's okay. He's concerned. And then we're told that there's this, when we were children, they told us it's a beauty contest. If you read more carefully, it's not exactly what it was, right? She comes every night and she leaves in the morning. But each girl gets one night with the king. That's the way it works. She gets 12 months to prepare herself with all sorts of cosmetics and whatever else, and perfumes and whatever else. Uvazen hanara ba'ayel ha-melech. Imagine this lovely life that these women had. They have a year to prepare for their one night with the king. During this time, they can, whatever they ask for, whatever treatments, skin treatments, perfumes, cosmetics, whatever else it is they ask for, whatever they get, whatever they want, they get. I assume also clothing, jewelry, whatever it is. And then, kol asher yom tomar yinatein la lavo ima mi beit hanashim ha beit hamelech. Ba'erev hi ba'a, in the evening she goes, u'bavoker hi shav, in the morning she comes back. El beit hanashim sheni, now she goes to the house of the concubines, the harem. Until now she was in the preparatory house, and now she goes to the harem, where there's someone else to take care of her. Sha'ashgaz sri samelech, shomer hafilakshim, lo tevo el ramelech, kim chafetz ba hamelech v'nikra avashen, that's her life. For the rest of her life, she's in the harem. If the king's ever interested in her, he'll call for her. That's it. She had her one chance, and that's it. Uvagia Tor Esther. I'm on Pasuk Tedvav now, verse 15. Uvagia Tor Esther bat Avichayel dod Mordechai. Asher lakach lo levat, lavo el ha-melech, lo viksha davar. All the other girls were given a choice. You can ask her whatever you want, and you know, blank check, whatever you want, you'll get. She asked for nothing. Now, in school, why did they teach us? Why did she ask for nothing? Because she didn't want to be picked. Right? That's what they told us in school. But it doesn't say that in the text. In fact, it also doesn't say that she tried to make herself unattractive. It doesn't say that. Actually, what does it say? Lo viksha davar. She didn't ask for anything. Kiim. At the Sher Yomar Hegai Sri Samela Shamer Nashim, whatever he decided that she should have, you know, he suggested a certain shade of eyeshadow, no doubt, or whatever, I don't know what it was, but whatever he suggested, she took. It doesn't say that she deliberately tried to prevent herself from being chosen. That's not the picture we're getting here. We're getting a picture here of somebody who's simply passive and does what she's told. She doesn't take initiative. All the other women were asking for this, or asking for that. She certainly doesn't seem like she was trying to be chosen, but it doesn't seem like she was trying not to be chosen either. She did what she was told. He said, what would you like? She said, I don't need anything. He said, well, take this and this and this. So she took this and this and this. And then we're told, Vayehav ha-melech et Esther mikol ha-nashim. Vatisachem v'chesed lefanav mikol ha-betulot. I'm sorry. First, Vatilakach, again, she was taken. El HaMelech. She was taken. And he loved her more than all the other women. And he approved of her. And he appointed her as queen. If we think about what we know already from the Megillah about Ahasuerus, and what we know about Esther, again, it says she was very beautiful, and I'm sure she was very beautiful. But so were, I'm sure, some of the others. Could there be another reason? A specific reason why he was attracted to her particularly?
Because she's passive.
She's exactly what he needs, right? She's passive. She's obedient. She's beautiful. She can be a trophy. She's passive. She's obedient. And she's anonymous. She has no background. She's an international cosmopolitan. She has no family. She has no nation. She's no ethnicity. His last queen stood up to him. His last queen had a power base. His last queen, he was hoping perhaps, and again, maybe in a moment of ill judgment, right? He was hoping to show that he had subdued her and whatever it is, and it backfired on him. So she's gone now. He needs somebody who's going to play the role. She's exactly what he's looking for.
We can see her taking some initiative later.
Oh, that's the hidden face. Whoa, get there. Hold on, one second. Exactly. But we need to see where that came from. Exactly, correct. She's going to go dramatic transformation. One moment, hold on. At this point, she doesn't do anything. Things are done to her. Vati lakach, right? The only thing she does is what she's told. Asher tziva aleha. Whatever she's told to take, she takes. Exactly. And perhaps for that reason, she's exactly what Ahasuerus was looking for.
Ahasuerus is also very passive. I mean, he asked his advisors here later on when he wanted to reward Mordechai. He asked his Ahasuerus is completely passive right through. So maybe that's.
Well, I don't know if passive is exactly the correct term. I don't think he views himself as passive, but he's certainly. But there are people who know how to push his buttons. He's being controlled. I don't know if he views himself that way.
He's always asking for advice.
He's asking for advice. And you see that people are playing with him, right? We'll get to that in a moment also. And particularly the one who rides him. So now,
asking for advice.
He's insecure. He's insecure, and we see already that his inner circle of advisors, right? They know how to play on that. They tell him, "No, she's not a threat to you. She's a threat to the entire society." Now look. One of those advisors, again, whether Mimuchan is Haman or not, and now let's get to our fourth main player here. Eventually, one of the advisors of the king rises to the second command. So let's now take a look at that. Perek Gimel, chapter 3. Achar advarim ha'ila gidal ha'melech ha'chashverosh et Haman ben Hamidata ha'agagi v'ninaseyu. So one of the officers rises to the top of the hierarchy. We're told that we're told about his lineage too. He comes from Agag. He comes from Amalek. He's the arch enemy of Am Yisrael. V'chol avdei haMelech asher b'shar haMelech korim u'mishtachavim laHaman kichein tziva lo haMelech. He commanded that everyone must bow to Haman. And they all do. Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachav. But Mordechai, for some reason, refuses to bow. Vayomru avdei haMelech asher b'shar haMelech haMordechai madu ata oveir mitzvat haMelech. Why are you doing this? Why are you violating this explicit command? Vayhi ki omram elav yom vayom v'lo shama aleihem. Mordechai refuses to. He's got some sort of a fundamental principle here. He will not bow to Haman. Now Mordechai, who told Esther not to tell anyone who she is, he makes his identity known. There's something ideological here. I refuse to bow to this man. Haman becomes infuriated that somebody refuses to bow to him. He could have easily executed Mordechai on the spot. But that's beneath him. He decides it's not enough. I have to wipe out his entire people. So what sort of image do we have of Haman here? Okay. Psychopath, megalomaniac, perhaps. And perhaps also, right, the classic anti-Semite here, the Amalekite, right? In other words, there's definitely two things going on here. On the one hand, there's a personal affront, and Haman, his ego is certainly very, very, we'll see later on also, Haman's ego is very large, and Mordechai is the only one who dares to challenge this ego, and that infuriates him, vayimalei Haman chema. Just a little bit different reaction than Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus feels threatened, feels insecure. Haman feels maybe too secure, right? And he feels very, very, he's angry. But there's also this ideological thing going on here, right? Mordechai makes clear that I refuse to bow because I'm a Yehudi, for some reason. Chazal talk about how he turned himself into some sort of an avodah zara, or he was wearing an idol around his neck, or whatever the story is, however you want to see it. But there's something ideological going on here. A Jew doesn't bow to this man, and he says, "I'm going to wipe out all of the Jews because of it." Right? There's something going on here. So we have now the following players here. Right? We have, if we want to talk, we have the insecure, paranoid king. We have the perhaps wise, perhaps ideologically committed leader of the Jews who's thinking something and seems to be thinking towards the future. We have obedient, passive Esther, and we have the megalomaniacal and egotistical and anti-Semitic Haman.
But Mordechai is also a person in the Chatzil. The fact that he's got access to mm-hmm. to see Esther when she's in crisis. So
undoubtedly.
So there might be a power struggle here between these two. The Mordechai and the Haman struggling for the same spot job kind of thing.
Well, I don't see Mordechai here trying to climb the ladder so much. In fact, I skipped. Perhaps I should have pointed out. We skipped the two psukim at the end of Perek Bet when Mordechai is actually the one to discover the plot to assassinate the king. And he goes ahead and he reports it.
Via Esther,
who mentions, and that's the source for that I mentioned earlier, like, because she said it, b'shem Mordechai, from this we see the value of saying things, b'shem Omro. Okay, so I see him actually as a loyal subject of the king here. I don't necessarily see that he's got his sights on them, but he certainly...
No, he might not have sights on the kingship, he might have sights on the Haman spot. So it's him and Haman fighting for the same advisor.
He's happy enough later on to accept wearing
right.
King's robe.
Could be.
And again, according to the Gemara, that's what gets him in trouble with the Sanhedrin. He's now denounced from the Sanhedrin because of that.
Well, that's not exactly... The Gemara says, Pershim mimenu mikta Sanhedrin. People
yeah, it has ramifications.
But only Mikta Sanhedrin. Yeah. Only the minority, actually. People quote that Gemara, they don't notice the significance of it. It's the minority of the Sanhedrin that disassociated from him according to that Gemara. When the majority vote in the Sanhedrin, the halacha is the other way, right?
Right.
But indeed, there was at least according to that, some opposition to him. But, okay. So... now Haman decides he wants to wipe out all of the Jews, and he cannot do so without. And so you see here, by the way, the Achashverosh is not completely passive. He still needs to get his authorization. He can't just do this on his own. How does he present it to him? He tells him the following. Yeshno am echad mefuzar umforad ben ha'amim bechol medinot malchutech. I mentioned this pasuk earlier. This morning, just as an aside, I've always felt that this pasuk coming from the mouth of one of our greatest enemies was perhaps one of the most eloquent descriptions of what Am Yisrael is. Am Echad, one people, Mefuzar Mefurad Ben Amin, although they are scattered among the nations. But what does he tell him? He tells him, V'datehem Shonot Mikol Am, they are different than all the other nations. They don't follow the king's laws. He doesn't provide any evidence of this. And we have no reason to suspect that there was any evidence to this, that they were not loyal subjects. They have a different religion. But the fact that they don't follow the king's laws, it doesn't say that he brought any evidence to support that. It's not a good idea. He presents himself, again, as the great defender of Achashverosh, someone who's concerned only with, you know, the security of the kingdom and his reign, and he says to Achashverosh, you know, you've got to. I suggest that we get rid of them, and not only that, but they have a lot of money, and it'll increase the coffers, the royal treasury. Achashverosh is so taken by this, and you see that Haman has Achashverosh wrapped around his finger completely, right? He presents this as, you know, your excellency, I have here, an intelligence briefing that there's this nation and that they're a threat to state security. I suggest we get rid of them. And not only that, but there'll be great economic benefits. And Achashverosh is so taken by him, and he believes him lock, stock, and barrel. He even tells him, you can keep all the money. I don't need the money. But he gives him full authority to do this, and that sets the whole thing into motion. Okay, let's skip a little bit here. What happens now? Okay, so the terrible decree All right, Haman knows how to push Achashverosh's buttons. It's presumably through that that he's risen to this position. He's gotten himself to the point that he is trusted more than anyone else. And he has this diabolical desire to wipe out all of the Jews. And he gets a royal decree issued. And that's what's going to happen. And of course, Mordechai passes Perek Dawud, Mordechai Adad Kol Asher Nasah. He rips his clothes, and Sakva Efer, etc. Esther finds out what's going on, and he tells her. Let's now come to what I think is the key turning point here. What happens? Mordechai now realizes, whether it was his plan or not, that he has created a situation in which there is a dire threat to nothing less than the existence of the Jewish people, and there's a royal decree. In a number of months, they're supposed to all be genocide. They're supposed to all be killed. And so he walks around in this very, very dramatic way. And Esther sends him clothing. He refuses to take it. And now, he responds. Perek Dalet Pasuk Zion. This is what I think is the key turning point here. Vayagid lo Mordechai. So Mordechai tells Esther's emissary, at Kol Asher Karahu. He tells her everything that happened. She apparently was oblivious, right there in the palace. She didn't know what was going on outside. He tells everything to her. And then it says, he tells her about the royal decree to destroy the Jews. And to tell her, and to command her, to go to the king and use her influence and beg him, and to beg him for mercy. He gives Esther a command. She tells her, he commands her to go into the king and to use her influence. And what does Esther always do when Mordechai commands her? She obeys. But she can't. She can't obey because the command that she was given here involves, he commanded her to go into the king. And there's this law, by the way, I meant to point this out earlier. If you see what the laws were in Shushan, the idea that the king here is sort of paranoid, you know, that no one's allowed to go to speak to him or to enter his inner chamber if they haven't been, and even his own laws can't be repealed. He's got all these very strange rules that seem, again, to try to, meant to show how powerful he is. But in any case, to go into the king without being invited was an act of rebellion. You could be killed. And she tells him, so what's he asking her? He's asking her to do something that's completely impossible for her. For anybody, especially for her. So she tries to explain that to him. She commands him to go to Mordechai. First time that she's commanding anyone, she's commanding a servant to tell Mordechai. You have to understand, cousin Mordechai, I can't do what you're asking me to do. Everyone knows around here. I'm not allowed to just walk in. Walking in is an act of rebellion. You don't do that. You can be put to death immediately. So she's now in a very difficult situation because Mordechai has commanded. She's always done what Mordechai commands her to do. That's her quality. She's obedient. And he told her to do something to break the rules. She can't break the rules, so she tries explaining that to him. It's been 30 days. I haven't been called. Now the question is, where's the key turning point of the Megillah? And some people point to various psukim. In my opinion, the turning point of the Megillah is this very next pasuk here. Pasuk Yudbet. Vayomer Mordechai lahashiv el Esther. She just told him, I know I've never refused one of your orders before, but I simply can't do it. You've just told me to do something that's just impossible. I cannot challenge authority in such a way. Vayomer Mordechai lahashiv el Esther. He says to her, Al tidami v'nafsheich limaleit beit ha-melech mikol ha-yudim. Don't think that by sitting there in the royal palace, you're going to be safe when the rest of us are executed. Ki im hacharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot, he says, If you dare to remain silent at this crucial moment, Revach v'hatzala ya'amod la'yehudim mimakom acher. I am certain salvation will come from somewhere else. And here we see that Mordechai sees right through the hidden face. He knows. He knows that God is up there watching what's going on, controlling what's going on. He knows. It's not a question to Mordechai whether Am Yisrael will be saved. He knows that Am Yisrael will be saved. The question is only how. And he says to her, if you dare to remain silent at this crucial moment, Revach v'hatzala ya'amod la'yehudim mimakom acher, indeed, salvation will come. God has many messengers, and the salvation will come in another way. Ve'atu ve'tavich tovedu, but you'll be destroyed. Umi yodea im la'et kazot higad malchut. And who knows? It's probably for this very moment that you became the queen. He says to Esther, I'm not stupid. I knew exactly what I was telling you to do. And I know exactly how difficult it is for anyone, especially for you. I know that I'm asking you to do something that goes against every fiber of your being. But I'm also telling you that this is the defining moment of your life. You were put there for a reason. You are the one who has the ability right now to be God's agent to bring about the salvation. If you dare to remain silent, yes, I know I'm asking you to do the most difficult thing you've ever done in your life. It's also the most important thing you'll ever do in your life. And you have one choice now. It's not a question whether Am Yisrael is going to be saved. The question is, what role are you going to play? Are you going to be the one to bring this about? Or are you simply going to become irrelevant? And then God will find another messenger, and you will have written yourself out of history, and you have failed. So yes, Esther, I'm commanding you to look inside yourself and to find sources of strength that you didn't know you had, and to do something that goes against everything that you have ever been. I know that you're a good girl. I know that you're obedient. I know you do what you're told. And I know that I just put you in an impossible situation because you've always done what I commanded you to do, and I'm commanding you to challenge someone else's authority. You've never done that. It's up to you now, Esther. And it's at this moment that Esther suddenly discovers her own hidden face. And she becomes a completely different person. Look at the next pasuk. Vatomer Esther lahashiv Mordechai lech. Suddenly she starts giving him orders. She starts issuing commands. Lech. She says to him, go. Knoset kol yudei. I'll do it, she says. But I'm doing it my way now. Now I'm taking charge. All of a sudden she's in charge. And she commands him, I want a 3-day fast, and I'm also going to fast, and then I'm going to go ahead and do it. And look at the next pasuk, it's so significant, the words. Pasuk Yudzayin, Vayavor Mordechai Vayaz, Kechol Asher Tzivta Alav Esther. Tzivta! She commanded him! And suddenly she takes charge, and she devises a plan that is nothing short of brilliant. Because she understands exactly who she's dealing with. And man, I'm staying a little bit late, so maybe I won't read all of it inside. But we'll read a few parts inside. But let's just understand what she does. She says, okay, I have 3 days. And she says to him, she understands. She says, I'm going to go in, v'kasher avadati avadati. Right? I understand I'm risking my life, and I've accepted your point, and we need to fast. Right? Which means she understands also that ultimately the success or failure of her mission is not up to her. It's up to the fact that there is someone up there who's in charge. I'm taking my life in my hands. We're going to fast for 3 days. And then I'm going to do what I'm going to do. But I need everyone behind me. I need everyone behind me, spiritually. And she devises a plan that's nothing short of brilliant. She comes into the king. On the third day, Batilbash Esther Malchut, she puts on her royal garments and all of her beauty. And she walks in unannounced and uninvited, taking her life in her hands, which she has never done before. And again, he chose her, it seems, because she wasn't the type of person to do this sort of thing. But he's intrigued. What's going on here? I've never seen that. I've never seen her like this. And he says, let's see what this is about. And he extends the sharvit. And he says to her, tell me, what's this all about? And what does she say to him? I'd like to invite you and Haman to a party. it's Ad, Haman, Esther. She's initiating something. There's something going on. He doesn't know what it is. But he says, okay, I'll come. So he comes to the party. And Haman comes to the party. And she knows exactly what she's doing. What's Haman thinking at this point? Right? She's playing on his ego, even more so. We'll see that explicitly in the Psukim in a few minutes. What's Ahasuerus thinking? Something's going on. I'm not sure who's on whose side here. Esther's involved. Haman's involved. Haman, my closest, most trusted servant, the one who's always looking after me. Esther, my trophy wife, who never did anything on her own. Something's going on here. So he comes, and he says to her, so tell me, Esther, what's this about? Ma she'ilatech, ma bakashatech, ad chatzi ha'malchut. Till half the kingdom, what would you like? And what does she say to him? I'll tell you what, your Royal Highness, I'll tell you what I really like more than anything else. I'd like you to come back tomorrow, and then I'll tell you.
And Haman.
And Haman. And she sends them both home to stew in their thoughts. It's brilliant. She's using, right, she understands exactly, she has deep insight into both their psychologies. She's using her femininity also here. She's playing it all, she's playing them off each other in a brilliant way. Again, it's her brilliance, but it's only through God's intervention that this could have worked, because it could have easily backfired. It's a very dangerous plan. But it's a brilliant plan. What happens? So, how do they each react? Exactly the way she wanted them to. Pasuk Tet. Vayetzei Haman b'yom ahu sameach b'tov lev. Haman walks out feeling on top of the world. This is unbelievable. Uchirot Haman et Mordechai b'shar ha'melech. There's only one thing that messes up his... This is the best day of his life, right? He's now reached the top. He was just invited to a royal banquet with only two other people there. King and the queen, and him. And what does he see? Uchirot Haman et Mordechai, Belokam, Belozan, and Mordechai, is there refusing to bow down? And he hates it. Vayitapak Haman, he holds himself back somehow, Vayavol deito, Vayishlach. It's almost comical the way the Megillah presents this here. It's a satire here. He calls in all of his family. Vayavol yato avav et zeresh ishto. He calls a meeting of all of his family, his wife and all of his children. Vayisaper lahem Haman. He tells them that kvod ashro v'rov banav. He tells them how great he is. Ve'kol asher gidlo hamelech. He talks about how he's reaching the top of the pyramid. Ve'at asher nisoal hasarim v'abdei hamelech. How he's already higher than all the other officers. Vayomer Haman. He says, Af lo hevia Esther amalka im hamelech el mishte asher asada kimoti. I was the only one there. And tomorrow again, I'm supposed to be coming back. This is all worthless to me. He says, he's out of his mind. A few more months, this man's going to be dead. You can't handle it for her? Right? But she's played on his ego to the point that he's lost all sense of proportion. And he throws caution to the winds. His wife says to him, so why don't you execute Mordechai right now? Build this huge, huge gallows, and you'll go and you need permission. But the king, he'll take care. He likes the idea. In the meantime, back at the palace. Balayla hahu nadida shnat ha-melech. The king couldn't sleep. Why couldn't he sleep? Sudden attack of insomnia, why couldn't he sleep? And he needs to sleep, so he asks them to come and read to him from the royal... Chronicles, why? He was bored, he needed a bedtime story? No, of course not. He can't sleep because he's worried what's going on. The same time that she played on Haman's ego, she's playing on Ahasuerus, on his insecurity. He's concerned. Somebody might, what's going on here? And what's going on with Haman and Esther? Something going on with the two of them? Who's on my side? Who's not? He calls, I want to go back, let's go through all the records. I want to find out who's my friends, who's my enemies. And they start going through the old records, and they happen to discover. Again, happen. This is where the Hester Panim. Right? This is where they happen to discover that years earlier, there's this man named Mordechai, who, according to, as far as Ahasuerus knows, has no connection to Esther, as far as he knows. But they discover this
standing dead.
Right, yeah. That just once upon a time, this individual had actually come to an Ahasuerus, just looking for who his allies are. Have we ever done anything? Was he rewarded? No, he wasn't. And as they've discovered this, who happens to walk in at exactly that moment? Haman, who's coming in order to ask for permission to execute Mordechai. Which from his perspective was such a it showed such a lack of discretion, right? If he would have played his cards right, he would have just waited out a few more months.
Or waited till morning. The fact that he's approached the
Early in the morning, right? You can't even wait till right. Exactly. At least do it in a more suave way. There's a meeting later. You're coming to right a few hours even, right? So he's lost all sense of proportion. Ahasuerus, who's suddenly beginning to suspect Haman. And why is he beginning to suspect Haman? Again, because Esther set this up perfectly. So suddenly he's not sure. So he decides to perform a test. And he says to Haman, tell me, who's that? Oh, it happens to be Haman's outside knocking on the door at 7 o'clock in the morning, or whatever it was. I don't know what time it was exactly. Just call him in. I'm glad you're here, Haman. I have a question for you. Ma lasot ba'ish asher hamelech hafeitz bikaro? If there's someone that we want to honor, what would be an appropriate way to honor him? Vayomer Haman belibo. Haman says to himself, and one thinks that Ahasuerus knew exactly what Haman would be thinking. But again, Haman has lost all sense of caution. So he says to himself, lemi achvotz hamelech lasot yekar yoter mimeni? Obviously, he must be talking about me. And I suspect that Ahasuerus knew that Haman would think that. He wanted to test him. So what does Haman suggest? Well, Your Honor, here's what I think would be an appropriate way to show honor to whoever it might be that you might, whoever this person is that you want to honor. Here's what I suggest would be an appropriate way to show your appreciation for this anonymous whoever it is. And remember, we're dealing with a king who's paranoid, who's insecure, who's afraid that people are trying to usurp his throne. And we're dealing with a king who right now is beginning to suspect that his closest advisor, who he thought was loyal to him, maybe isn't so loyal, who's presumably just given him this question as a test to see. And here's what he suggests. Yaviu levush malchut asher levash bo hamelech. I think we should bring the royal garments that the king himself wears. V'sus asher rechav alav hamelech, and the horse that the king rides. V'asher nitan keter malchut b'rosho, and let this person wear the royal crown. V'natom alavush v'sus al yad ish misarei hamelech apartamim, and they should dress this person up and have somebody walk through the street saying, kacha ye'aseh la'ish asher hamelech hafeitz bikaro. And Ahasuerus assumedly knows exactly what he's dealing with, and he tells him, man, that's a great idea, so please do exactly what you said. Although the Mefarshim point out, he leaves out the royal crown. He says, take the levush and the sus, but not the crown. Exempta, you've gone a little too far. But put this all on Mordechai. At this point, the chips have all gone. Now, all that has to happen, they come back into the, right, they bring in, Mordechai's already been paraded through the streets in his royal garments, Haman already feels, and they drag him to the party, and all that's left now for Esther to do is to simply say, listen, there's someone out there who's trying to eradicate my people, and of course Ahasuerus doesn't even know who her people is. Haman hara hazeh, and everything, everything at that point is a done deal, so to speak. So, how did the nace come about? There's hidden faces here. There's God's hidden face, of course, and minhag that we have based on another midrash. The midrash that we mentioned, that God's name is not mentioned, and there's a midrashic idea that whenever it says Hamelech, right? Without Hamelech Ahasuerus, when it just says the king, without describing which king, it can also be read as a reference to the King of Kings. We have, of course, a very beautiful minhag. I assume they do it here in Manchester. Most Ashkenazi communities have this minhag that when we read that pasuk, Balayla hu nadida shnat Hamelech, right? It's done with a Balayla hu nadida shnat Hamelech, and of course that is takes us to a completely different time and place. That's the tomb from the Elohim Noraim, HaMelech. Right? The Melech never sleeps, and there's a very beautiful poetic allusions going on there. The earthly king is not sleeping. The king in heaven, he nei lo yanum leishan shemer Yisrael, of course. So God's face is hidden. He hides his face. in the threat of punishment, and he hides his face in this case also. And you have to look beneath the surface to see he's there. Mordechai understood that he was there when he told Esther what he told her. Esther understood that he was there when she said you have to fast for 3 days. And of course, the plan, as brilliant as it was, could have just as easily failed. It was a very risky plan. But there's another hidden face as well. And because, particularly because, God hides his face, so the role of human beings becomes greater. Right? When God reveals himself, a month later we'll celebrate Pesach, and that was a very different type of miracle. Right? On Pesach, God did everything. And Moshe Rabbeinu was told, when it came to splitting the sea, Moshe Rabbeinu was told, Hashem yilachem lachem atem tacharishun. God's fighting this battle, you just be quiet. But when God hides his face, so he acts through the agency of human beings. And in this case, that's what Mordechai told Esther. He said, look, you're going to have to look inside yourself and see your own hidden face. And you're going to have to look inside yourself and see that the strengths that you didn't realize you had. Because God put you in this situation. And it's clear. It's clear that it's for this moment in your miyodeyam la'id kazot tigan l'malchud. It's clear that this is the defining moment of your life. And so, your only choice is what role you're going to play. God's plan for history is going to happen. The question is, are you going to fulfill your role or not? And she looks inside. And indeed, in an instant, she finds strength that she didn't know she had, and she transforms into a completely different person. From totally passive, totally obedient, just doing what she's told, she suddenly starts issuing commands, and she starts devising a plan that showed a deep, deep insight into the personalities of the people she was dealing with, beat Haman at his own game. Haman had Ahasuerus wrapped around his finger, and in an instant she wraps both of them around her finger. And she gets them both to do exactly what needs to happen, and the chips then fall, and it is through both of those, the revelation of both of those hidden faces. Therefore, God reveals his face, or doesn't. We need to reveal God's face in the matter, and the revelation of God's hidden face comes through Esther's discovery of her own hidden face. I think there's a very, very powerful message in this, and we all, at various times, find ourselves, maybe not quite as dramatic most of the time, but we all very much, at times, find ourselves in a situation where, in hacharesh tacharishi ba'it hazot, where it's clear to us what we need to do, and it's very difficult. At times, it requires us, we all are faced with challenges at one point or another, where we sometimes need to look deep inside to find strength that we didn't know we had, and to do things which go very much against our nature. And it requires a deep sense of faith in the justice of whatever it is that we believe in and whatever the situation requires, and a deep sense of faith in God. And when faced with those challenges, if we can follow Esther's model and look inside and find that strength and discover our own hidden face, so that's where the redemption comes. That's where the redemption of each individual comes from, and there's no doubt that Esther redeemed herself in those moments, grows and transforms into a person that she probably didn't understand she could be, and in doing so brings salvation to the entire Jewish people and the entire world. Every one of us has our Esther moment, and I think that's the powerful message of Purim, and again, perhaps the deep meaning behind the minhag of the wearing of the mask, not only that we have to realize that God hides his face, but that also we hide our own faces, and ultimately, the purpose of wearing that mask is to learn how to take it off, and to reveal the deepness that's within. And that's also, by the way, perhaps part of the idea of the drinking on Purim. Drinking on Purim is a minhag that's become, correctly so, somewhat controversial and somewhat debated to what extent it should be done, should not be done. And but one thing is clear: the genuine purpose of that minhag, echad amarbe v'echad mari, whether you drink a little, you drink a lot. But the idea of the drinking is also to help one get in touch with one's inner self, and to find the hidden face that's within, and to redeem both ourselves and hopefully bring redemption to the entire world in the process.
Thank you, Rabbi Haber, for an excellent shiur. I'm sure it will enrich our understanding of the Megillah when we hear it in a couple of weeks. Are there any questions for Rabbi Haber before we wrap up and have some hot drinks and things.
How did Homon get to such an amazing recognition?
So again, it's from what I can see in the Megillah, he was a good politician, and he knew how to push Achashverosh's button. He knew how to play. You see from the Megillah what he did. Certainly if he's Memuchan, if we take that Midrash, so he's doing it earlier with Vashti, and certainly when it comes to his plan with Mordechai, right? He presents himself, he knows how to get Achashverosh to believe that he's a very loyal servant, and he does it also by stepping on other people, and, by presenting others as a threat, and I'm the one here who's protecting you. And to a certain point, it worked. And the only thing that did him in was when he let his own ego take over.
There's another theory that if he knew his lineage and that he comes from Agagi, and therefore he knows that he's royal and he should be the rightful heir to the throne, uh-huh. whereas this guy is just someone who's taken over by Koach, and he's constantly striving for that.
Okay.
For that element.
That may be part of what's feeding his ego, is that yeah. he's got these delusions of grandeur based on his background or whatever.
Well,
another
demographic type questions. You mentioned
well, again, it to some extent depends on exactly when this took place. But in any case, the number that went back in Shivat Zion was only a few 20-something thousand people went back.
Okay, so most people still in Babel.
In Babel and in the other provinces also. There have been people that have been exiled earlier also by Ashur, the 10 tribes, and it's not clear what happened to them. Is also Machlokus and the Gemara. Are they ever coming back, not coming back? It seems some of them may have already come back earlier and they're scattered around. But and they also were Jews in Egypt, we know.
So if Haman succeeded, he would have not arrested everyone, but a vast majority of them would have been.
It seems to say everyone that was in the Persian Empire.
Right.
Mehodabad Kush, that might have been everyone. I don't know. I don't know if there were any Jews outside of the area controlled by Persia at that time.
I'll just ask, just after the bit where he obviously then takes Mordechai on the royal horse, etc., he goes back to his wife, and sort of breaks down and tells her what happened. And then she turns around and says, she says in it that if Mordechai comes from the heritage of the Jews, then you're never going to win. I don't understand.
No, that's not what she says. She says, once you've begun to fall, you're never going to get up again.
Okay. Because right? She obviously knew already that Mordechai was a Jew, because every time Haman would come in, he'd
right.
say, Mordechai, how you Yehudi?
And certainly, listen, certainly the idea, there's a lot going on there also about the idea of Amalek and Esav. Mm-hmm. Amalek comes from Esav, right? And what did Yaakov say to Esav? What did Yitzchak say to Esav? He told him that as long as Yaakov is down, you'll be up, and when he comes up, you're going to go down. Oh. Right? That's what she says. She says that if once you've begun to fall, there's no coming up. And look, it could be also that our enemies, I alluded to this earlier, but I often feel that our enemies understand us much better than we understand ourselves. You know, one of the Nazis was executed at Nuremberg. You know this? One of the Nazis that was executed in the Nuremberg executions, his last words were Purim Fest 1945 or something like that. And as he understood very clearly Purimfest, Purim in German, right? He had read the Bible. He understood exactly that he's Amalek, and that the Jews are the Jews. And when he was about to be executed, he understood very clearly that he was Haman and that he had fallen. That's just.
Zeresh also plays with Haman. If you notice the way when he speaks to Zeresh, at first she's mentioned last in the list of Kol Ha'avav, and then when she digs it into him, suddenly she's the first.
Interesting. I never noticed that, but that's an interesting point also. That might also go back into the whole women thing.
From the place of women in society. This is her opportunity to kick
uh-huh.
back.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I never noticed that, but that's very interesting, yeah.
Can I just make one more answer? Just if anybody is interested in getting to find out more information about the events that Shema might be putting on, please let us know. And also, if anybody would like to make a donation to help Shema put on these types of events, I would be more than happy to, Emily. But no pressure, but we will judge you. And
I have to say, a crowd of this size on a Saturday night for a shiur is very impressive. So, very proud of you also. I should have said that at the outset.